And you are listening to Radio Free Cybertron BotCon Weekend 2001. As promised, I did go to BotCon, but all did not go according to plan. First, we started an hour late, meaning that we got there an hour late. So all the people that I was going to meet up with, well, I wasn't there to meet with them. The biggest disappointment for me today was that I only was able to be there for 3 hours. The people that I rode with got bored. And while I admit that I did find the convention kind of boring up until the G1 voice panel, voice actors panel, after that I got into the groove of things and I started to enjoy myself. I met up with some of my friends. Some people that I've wanted to meet, like Doug Glenn, Skyflight, other people like that. I met MCypher, finally in person, Walkie. I finally met John DeLuna, our very own John DeLuna, and Anthony, Tony Fitz, Brew, Kelly. Didn't get to meet Hooper X, which saddened me. Same thing goes for Recharge and Mad Max MFP. And I was supposed to meet several of our listeners, but I just didn't have time, nor the ability to find anybody. There were a lot of people there. I don't know the exact count, but I'd say close to 2,000, if not over. It was packed. The convention itself was packed. Lots of people. Lots of interesting smells. Walking between, 30 people in any given tumor or arterial blockage, it's you're going to get close enough to get a good whiff of it, and it was there, and I think you know what that is. It was pretty bad. The dealer rooms, there were two of them, a smaller one and a larger one. I didn't see anything that I particularly wanted. I saw a few things. The only thing off the top of my head that I actually wanted that I saw was a Mittenbox Skylynx. And that was actually out of my price range because I only took $170 with me. I ended up buying nothing, and I'm proud of myself. I actually ended up buying a new video card for my computer out of that on the way home. There were a lot of people there, a lot of people that I wanted to meet that I didn't get to, a lot of people that I did meet. There were there was the art room that was there, lots of neat stuff. I didn't see the video room. I believe there was one there, but I just didn't see it. I did catch the G1 voice actors panel, and that's the only thing that I had time to catch. And that will be the most of it, will be ending up the show this week. It's over an hour long. I did get to talk to John DeLuna and some other people from RFC, and I have a little bit of From the Floor coverage, which it's not really coverage. It's basically me rambling on about things. Some of it's not fit to be broadcast, but I'll probably do it anyway next week whenever I find the tape. It's kind of missing now. But on the show this week, we only really have two things. We have the great, truly great Transformers website, Part 3, and considering the fact that I'm going on 2 hours sleep over the past 44 hours, it's going to be brief. The bulk of the show will definitely be coverage from the G1 voice actors panel. I do want to mention before, though, we get into the show, that the convention exclusives, the toys anyway, this year were, for those of you who don't know, was a repainted Transmetal 2 Black Arachnia minus the Bustier, repainted in silver and pink, and called RC. And the first 800 of them had a little voice chip, apparently, that wouldn't shut up. It said RC Maximize, voiced by Susan Blue. And the other was, if you saw it from eBay months and months ago, from a Spooky, was the Tagatron, with Transmetal Tagatron, which is the white and blue repaint of X9 Metal's Ravage. And by the way, I did see Neo Trion's blue Transmetal to Megatron, which that was pretty cool, and it's nice to actually see that in person. And now, beyond question or doubt, it's real. I also saw the green Ramulus and blue Optimus Minor. And, you know, that's it. Time to start off the show with the great Transformers websites, or the sites that don't suck.
Grant me mercy, I beg of you!
You, who are without mercy, now plead for it? Well, if I had any mercy, I wouldn't have to ask for some, now would I? You don't know what the word means, do you? I thought you had a more impressive vocabulary than that.
Look out! He's got a gun!
He is a gun, Cup.
Okay, the first .com in our series is up this week, and that is, drumroll please, tfarchive.com. You know, there are a lot of sites out there with multimedia, and some of them, you know, once a week you go download an episode, that's it, you know, you're done. Sometimes, you know, it's not even that, you know, they may have two or three episodes up, and once you're there, you know, go to the message board and post. You know, they draw you in, and then they keep you with whatever. But tfarchive.com is one of the few sites that legitimately can call itself a multimedia archive. It has, for the record, it has G1 episodes, Beast Wars episodes, Beast Machines, the those beautiful dubs. There's actually music from the soundtrack, Transformers movie soundtrack and real audio, commercials, bukus of them, intros, outros, bumpers, sounds, pictures, tons and tons and tons and tons and tons of things. I know it doesn't sound like a lot, but while there's not a ton of variety, there is definitely quantity there and quality. Also, on the site, there's the comics. You know, the complete run of Transformers Generation 1, the U.S. run, and I think G.I. Joe versus the Transformers, and they are good scans, other than like a couple of other sites whose scans aren't that great. Also, Brendan has episodes and tapes for sale, original tapes, I believe. Also, there is a message board, which is, you know, obligatory these days. The site is sort of, you know, old school. It has the Transformers background. It says the Transformers, like, you know, every other site made in 1997. I don't remember if there's a background sound or not. There may have been in the past. While the layout of the site is old looking, it's also very functional. You know, it doesn't go about abusing Photoshop. It goes against the grain, against the current ways of thinking. It's mostly text, very little pictures. It's quick to load. I mean, that's important. While sometimes it may be hard to connect to a file, especially an episode, and it's generally not too big a problem. As far as all the archives go, tfarchive.com, the Transformers archive, is by far the best, just for variety, quantity, quality, and reliability. It's been there for a while, and it will almost certainly be there for some time to come. And that is my Insomniac-inspired review of TFArchive.com. It is a Transformers website that does not suck. Coming up now on Radio Free Cybertron is the G1 Voice Actors Panel from BotCon.
You're listening to Radio Free Cybertron.
The only limitations that it has is the limitations of the actor performing it. We work in a medium that takes itself much more seriously now than it ever has, I think, in the past. Normally, when a show is first in its formative stages, we'll see breakdowns, drawings. Sometimes the artists will be present. People will talk to you about their vision for a project thematically or character-wise. And it's a wonderful, interesting challenge. It's not just silly voices or different voices, usually, or at least what I've found in the projects I've been on. You're surrounded by people who care. What was nice about the people we met last night, the people we're meeting in elevators and lobbies, is what we perceive as far as a body of work that is past tense for us, was performed some time ago, is still clearly present tense and presumably future tense because you as audience and interested parties care. I'm just bringing that to your attention. I'm having a really good time meeting everybody.
Yeah, you guys are super. You know, you must know that for us, when we grew up, it was Mel Blanc and people like that, and John Stevens.
Like John Stevens.
I can tell you how old John is, but we cut him in half and count the rings, and you don't find out.
Let me count the rings. No, it's mentally. I bring you greetings from some of the most maligned man in our sessions, and that's Wally Bird, who directed him. He couldn't be here, and if he had been, he would give you a chapter and verse. Without him, this show couldn't have really got together. Even though he was a grill master and a hard taskmaster, he did it all. I think he was the only one privy to a storyboard, which made him interesting. He took us through every nuance of the characters that we worked on as we were on mic. In fact, he read every line for us.
Yes.
They smile, they know. But even to this day, just 17 years later, people are even talking about Wally Bird, you know. But without him, he was a driving force. And looking back on it, I say this show never probably would have come to air.
He had about 20 of us in one room. God bless you. He had about 20 of us in one room, and it's kind of like a comics convention. You have to remember that although we did voiceovers, many of us were doing on-camera work, and we're appearing in television shows at the same time. So we were always on. All the group, everybody, even someone like Chris Latta of The Dear Departed, was a stand-up comic. And then you had myself and Frank and Greg, a tremendous theater background. And John was doing television. John and I did a soap opera together years ago. And he was the killer, and I was wondering if you would find out that he was killing his wife.
What was that call?
And we, all of us, were what we referred to as, you know, Susie's expression, voicing off. So we all sat around and just joked and got silly, and Wally had to keep us in tow and keep us focused in what we were doing. And then, as you can see by some of the programs, we've done six or seven voices, and then we at the same time, I think somewhere around there, correlated with G.I. Joe, and we had other shows at the same time. So after a while, you had to remember what characters you had for that particular show, and if you forgot them, you literally had voice-timers. You didn't know where the heck you were. So Wally had to bring you back. And that's almost a deja vu, because yesterday we were talking to some of the guys and ladies that came up to talk to us, and they said, oh yeah, I really love that character. And I go, what did it sound like? And you knew, you described it. Oh yeah, this would sound like it. But he's working, this would sound like it. People, oh yeah, then now, then you brought it back. And then we could remember what it was we did for those particular characters. So thank you for bringing me back to that.
Well, there was such a thing as a reference tape, which they all carried, because you'd say, what did I do? When was that? That's 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago. And they were new. The characters were new. So. At the time, and after a while, you got into it and you had a memory of it. But the reference tapes, we didn't have the last night, and when you ask for a certain character to be reproduced for you, we get in trouble with it sometimes.
even with the voice references, it's still, you can't underestimate, on some, I'm not underestimating our contribution to the show, to the characters, and to literally animating these visual characters, but on some level, we're the bottom of the food chain. We're given the words that someone else has honed down and made work. Wally Burr, on the other side of the glass, was the only person with access, aside from the producers and consultants, who had the big picture and knew how things fit. So when we would literally do more on the other side of the glass, and he would push us and push us and push us for a performance above and beyond, he was the only one who knew what that was to marry with later in an animated state. So he worked us hard. He was a drill sergeant. And that brings up another interesting point, because as far as reference tapes, I was talking to somebody about this last night. One thing actors and voice actors are always cautioned about is don't deliver anything in an audition that you can't sustain. When I got Grimlock, they said, we have good news and bad news. You got the part! Now for 70 or 80 or however many shows, you need to sustain that. I'm not of the opinion that you should do anything performance-wise by holding back or restraining. I think the real freedom is just in letting go. So I always trusted that it would be there, and it always was there, but it was a drain.
But you had any blood. You had something like blood on the windows there.
I remember that. I think it was Michael who retrieved my tonsils, which were...
While he's on the other side, he's thinking, you make that even bigger. Wally wanted to be on our side.
You make that bigger, you'd be... That's not big enough.
God, this is just a human being we have here.
Oh, no, that's not true.
Actually, not this machine. You have a question. Well, his outtakes are now on the porno channel. Because you don't want to hear the things that we said. While he's still alive, well alive, and in the valley, yeah, I must have lived there somewhere.
It would be possible to, his company is still called Wally Burr Recording. I do know that most engineers keep a quarter-inch tape running on sessions, and sometimes it winds up on a Christmas reel that you hear at a party, sometimes it winds up on a shelf, sometimes it's disregarded, but maybe your interest would encourage them to find it. It may exist somewhere.
Yeah, you would hear something in the course of doing a session. We would turn around and I'd say, like, oh, Grimlock, you got the bluest eyes.
I bet you say that to all the Dinobots.
Well, Wally is very much alive, and he just returned from Europe, where he visited the scene of his D-Day plus four landing on Utah Beach. So he was in the thick of it. He was an artillery, a tank commander, excuse me, and went through hell over there in World War II. So he was it was an emotional visit for him, and the fact that he just got back from Europe, he was looking forward to another trip. But he sends his love.
You'll get to meet him. He's a very interesting guy. Yeah. We talked about the fact that when we did the film, Transformers, as you all know, Orson Welles, the great Orson Welles, was on the film. And I thank you. I wanted to be there at that session. I'll make believe I'm a lackey. I'll run up alongside and go, Master, whatever it is you want, just so I can. No, he really asked that it just be him and just the immediate guys who would be taking on the director. And at one point, word came back that Wally had made a suggestion. Wally, during the course of directing you, will sometimes read for you. And
kind of do it for you. You know, this is the
direction of the line. And if you were grown, and you sounded like this.
He wanted you to sound like that because you were going to be Butch and get in there. And you wanted the Dinobots.
And so when Orson Welles was doing his Orson Welles thing, I said, Mr. Welles, could you listen? You're not going to give me a line, lady, are you? Orson. And then later on, as you probably know, I think it was about the end of the film or the middle of the film, something Orson Welles had passed away. And I had spread the word that Wally killed Orson Welles. And I said, and his last words were, burn. And then my dad really took it well. He said, oh, good, terrible, he said, yeah. Oh, anyone who make it past the Susan Room? They're dead. Yeah. It's really sad.
I thought it was once word for a rose.
I think it's appropriate that Orson Welles' last part was as a galactic entity. Because he nearly had that stature on Earth.
And you, yes. Orson Welles played a planet, yeah, but that's exactly what he said, and he was. He was a planet in real life. I mean, you let him
say it.
Yes, gentlemen here. What's your name? Say it again. Senator. Senator, stand up. I have a question, sir. Now. Yes.
From the lobby floor, I judge films based on what it is that they seek to accomplish. And if someone is seeking to accomplish the best CGI animated epic tale that they can, you know, so be it. That's fine. I don't think, I have to hope that that will never be at the expense of a live action product. You know, if you follow that to its illogical extreme, they can probably digitize voice chips of Humphrey Bogart on and cast 40s actors and digitize their voices or their images. You know, it could all be abstracted to the nth degree, but I don't feel that an audience will accept that at the expense of everything else.
Surely won't have a convention, will you? You can't talk to, will you? Another question, same question there. Give me your rectal mic.
Yo, man. Yo.
Gentlemen, given all of that, how does an aspiring young voice actor get involved in
this?
Okay, you know, the question always comes up about, people sometimes call me because I do teach voice animation just in my area. I'm not flying any place to do this. But I teach voice animation basically to the professional actor, because a lot of professional actors want to extend themselves in that direction, and they're not sure just exactly what they're going to do in terms of mic technique. They're used to moving and doing things, etc. And I teach it from an acting standpoint. So when I get a call from somebody that says, hello, another one tells me I have this fabulous voice. Or, I got this great voice, and a lot of people tell me I should be doing voiceovers and I want to do animation. And I say, look, let me make a comparison here. Having a voice, or a good voice, is okay. Everyone's got a voice, obviously. There's no such thing as a great voice, particularly. Because you can use anything in terms of animation. You can twist it a certain way. If you got a voice like this, you know, or without a voice like this, whatever it is, it may work for you. But just having the voice and saying, well, let's say a particularly what you think is a good voice, is like having a 12-inch penis. It's of no value to anybody unless it gets hard.
I don't like that now.
So, the point is, you study acting. You know how to use that tool. And that tool is of no value to you if you don't know how to use it. And I tell everybody that over the phone. And of course, there's a lot of silence and a click buzz because they got the wrong number. You study acting. If you want to do voiceovers, you get into acting. You get into a group. You get into an improv group. You study with a teacher. And you learn to develop a character. It is not just going,
okay, I can do this voice. That's very good.
Well, that goes nowhere unless you can act like this man and that man can act. And make that character come alive. Otherwise, that voice is what, folks? Just look at me.
Speaking of that, as far as the nuts and bolts, it sounds cryptic, but it...
This will never be done.
This is going to sound like a non-answer, but it's not. What you do is what comes next. If you're in need of those classes, if you're in need of expanding your abilities as a performer, then you do that next. If you're in need of a tape which you don't yet have, you do that next. If you're in need of really, really looking at what you bring to the table and making sure that you have something distinctive to offer, and that's where that voice that sounds like no one else absolutely works in your favor. At some point, you get off the bus, you knock on doors, you make mistakes, and you wait for something good, like an opportunity to happen. I had an acting teacher who said, if no one can talk you out of this, maybe you should do it. If anyone can talk you out of this, spare yourself. It's a hard go. The no's so far exceed the yeses, that it tests your mettle every day. That never stops. You are condemning yourself to a life of walking through doors and meeting people who don't know you and convincing them how much they need you. And if you don't have a sense of what's special about yourself, what you bring to the party, and how you make their headaches easier, it's not going to happen. You know, we are all sizes, shapes, and colors, but This is a career for a brave person. There is ego involved in the best way, not the worst way. But you got to know who you are walking in the door, because they're not going to tell you, and they're going to wait for you to make it clear to them.
And I broke into animation with a great teacher, and that was Jill Barbera, Hanna-Barbera production. See? And he had two things. Make it loud, because I'm paying a lot of money for this, so you can hear it. And he leaned heavily on impressions. He loved impressions of people. But Dawes Butler, who was Yogi Bear and this and that, they were all pick-offs on known people. And if you could do that for him, too, he would say, out of the blue, he called me on the phone and said, can you do? I said, I don't know, Joe, I've never tried it. And he said, well, try it. And I had to give him an audition over the phone. And he said, that works, and I come in and do this thing. And I went places I had never been before, and it worked. Only because of his encouragement and his buying certain things that I tried sometimes for the first time. But it was also, I found, interesting to have a handle to go back to the next week. So I did this. A bad Catherine Hepburn. No, you could actually do Catherine Hepburn as a male, and I didn't get a sound that was acceptable. I'm looking at it out of the blue, but nevertheless, it was a handle that you had for the next time you work the show in a series, we'll say. You could grab onto this and go, and maybe expand on it. A lot of characters that started out, in fact, one story Joe told, and this is true, that we were working at Winstone. And Mel Blanc came back after our hiatus. We would do 39 shows, take off, come back and do 39 shows. And Joe said, that's very good, Mel, but it ain't Bonnie Rebel. And Mel went, because he had never been told that that wasn't on the nose. And he was right. Joe was right. He had an infallible ear. And he brought him back to what he was supposed to be. So if it could happen to Mel Blanc, it can happen to anybody, I guess.
But you have to convince yourself. You must convince yourself. One of the things I teach is plagiarize, don't plagiarize. It's why God made you, so you plagiarize. And what you do is, I teach my class, and I say, you go to watch AMC movies. Watch the old characters from the 40s and the 30s, because they were very specialized. They had qualities that some you don't see a great deal of today. There are some today, but not as much, that have a special wrinkle to their sound. Suppose your girl wanted to play, have to play the character of a bimbo. Okay? I would suggest Judy Holliday from Born Yesterday.
Because she talked like that, right?
And then you have Bullets Over Broadway. I think it's Meg or one of the Tilly sisters.
And she's got that sound over there.
That is sort of your standard basic. So you wind up not only developing as an actor or an actress, but you also have to know where you're going with that character. When you look at a sheet, they give us a sheet and they say, okay, this is a turtle. What are you going to do? Who? My first concept is, and I think for many of us, is who would do this if this was an on-camera? Would you have Strother Martin? Who would play this character? Would they have eyes over here? You know, perhaps he talks like this. Maybe it's a turtle who talks like this.
Lindsay talks like this.
Absolutely. And you've got your choices. You've got your areas to go with it. Who possibly sounded like that? We talk about Dawes. We talk about Yogi Bear and those characters. Those were, to my ear, and I imagine to Dawes as well, if you remember the Jackie Gleason show, it was Art Carney.
Hey, how you doing?
That's where a lot of that stuff comes from. It is a form of plagiarism, but they got it from somebody else. They got it possibly from life or from a character that they've seen. And that's what Mel Blanc, who I worked with and adored, he listened to other people as well. You don't just say, I'm going to do a voice. That's not how it works. It has to come from a granite nucleus of acting ability, because you have to do the highs and the lows. And a classic example is, a lot of times when we did shows, I did Smurfs for about 5 or 6 years or something, and they would bring in guest stars. And some of the guest stars they brought in did wonderful impressions, but they couldn't do those characters outside of their act. They couldn't do the character doing the dialogue that they were given, because they basically weren't actors. They were impressions. You have to go a step further.
True. Any multi-voiced actor, flexible enough and versatile enough to call yourself a multi-voice actor, should have one and one answer only to one of the standard questions, which is how many voices do you do? The only answer is, I don't know. Because every time You're furnished with a rendering by an artist who cares about his work, and he explains to you his passion in creating what he's attempting to create, and a director who has a vision for a whole show, and a breakdown which often explains hopes, dreams, fears, strengths, weaknesses. It needs to trigger something in your brain, and together, I mean, I believe that all art is collaborative, and the more I can glean from the other people who care about a project, the more it feeds what I bring to the party. And so, like John was saying, you open your mouth and see what comes out, and maybe it's a sum total of three or four of those characters that we've talked about, and something new is born, and you're as surprised as they are, and everybody says, that works. And you're off.
I recall a guy who used to bill himself as a man of a thousand voices, and then this guy inside would say, and they all sound the same.
There's somebody back here too. All the way in the back.
All
the way
in
the microphone. Who's got it? You've got it. It's yours.
I win.
He wins. Now with the microphone, wins. You have to get it next. Go ahead.
Bonus points for the Tom Lehrer record.
Yes. Yes, it is Tom Lehrer. Absolutely. Good for you. But I think it also came before him. I think that plagiarizing, if I'm not mistaken, came from Danny Kaye from a motion picture called Lady in the Dark. And it came from a song. Yeah, go ahead.
I forgot what
all this wonderful information.
You can ask me a question. Yeah.
Pretend for a moment the other guys aren't here and describe what they're like and what it looked like to work with them.
To work with these two guys?
Yeah, it's all for all of you.
Well, when John wasn't moaning while we were, and I remember once when Greg went himself to the restroom. No, professionals. I mean, it's just bottom line professional. And quieter, actually, than most of the guys that we work with. I mean, quieter than, sort of more dependable to listen to. For the director, at least if I was a director, I'd be more comfortable rather than working with me or Peter Cullen or Frank, who is silly, or the late Chris Laddock, who is sillier than most and louder than most. And interestingly enough, what we all did, whether we realized it or not, because it's second nature, is listen to the other character's character, to their voices, and sometimes might even have done it on the way home, because God knows they might get struck with the flu and might have to fill in, or maybe something worse. So you wound up trying to say, well, can you do Starscream? Can you do this other character? Well, you know, some of us have, I didn't have the pipes for most of that. I had the pipes for what I had for, and that was pretty much it. I probably could do Subaru, but that's about it. But for the most part, you when, in terms of the other actors, most of us were really pretty wacky. Greg would slide them in, and John would slide them in. We'd have to listen carefully, and we get this bit of wisdom. But most of us were loud. We'd sort of climb over the curtain. Next batter. Wait a second. I know we got somebody all in the back. He's got the mic back.
That would be your name.
And you are?
My name is Charles.
Okay, Charles.
First of all, I'd like to say it's an honor to be here and in your great mind presence.
And we can send me about you guys.
Thank you.
No, that's not really mine.
Fine.
You're welcome.
Yes.
But, Mr. Berg, I have a
comment. Me not worthy!
Comment about something you said earlier. I honestly believe that voice actors are not the bottom of the food chain. The writers, yes, they make the words, but the voice actors bring the passion. They're the ones that deliver.
Not the right.
Thank you. And I was trying to clarify that I'm not underestimating that contribution. But we are furnished with the words that someone else labored over. We're in session to bring life to that and breathe life to that.
Yes, and I believe that each and every one of you has done a marvelous job with the characters. Marvelous job. And one of the questions I have, one of many which I probably won't be able to ask, but how exactly do you get that one particular tone or pitch for that character? Like, how did you come across for Grimlock? How did you know that was Grimlock?
I've been sort of taken from the time I used to ride the bus with my mom when I was little by the way people's faces were constructed, and I remember this as an early memory. And I would engage people on the bus in conversation to see if they sounded like I thought they were going to sound.
Are you my buddy?
And I saw the metal in Grimlock, and when I first auditioned it, for the first several months, I could sort of find it. I wanted something metallic and not too high in the IQ or robotic gene pool. And the rest was fishing with. And I think the other thing that I probably tried at the outset to bring to it was sort of this stupidity and nobility in the same entity. And I think the whole Transformer phenomenon, there is sort of a responsibility that comes with that much size and that much strength. And if it's used for good, then it's good to the 100th power. If it's used for evil, it's evil to the 100th power. And that's the dynamic of light and dark. But I remember at the outset, everybody made fun of me as I did it.
At first, I was really restraining my facial muscles with my old head to head.
And Gary Owens in that chat. Little Gary Owens in that.
There you go. In that restraint, the rest is being fed again by people on the other side of the glass that have the big picture. It works or it doesn't. And you keep fiddling and fine-tuning and changing and refining until somebody says, don't forget what you just did. That we can ride out for as long as we need to. I think that's true with the creation of every character. Tennis players say there's a sweet spot on the racket. And if the ball hits that sweet spot, you never forget what that felt like. You may not be able to find it every time you want to, but you know where that zone is, and you need to lock it in mentally. And that's an ability. I don't know if that's teachable, but you recognize it when it happens to you.
When he's mouthing, you sound totally different. I'm like, if he speaks like this, and that
one. I worked with Buddy Hackett at one point, and they couldn't get the sound right. And he said, well, you don't want to be over here, because I want to talk
about them. Dude, where's the microphone? The
microphone's
over there, okay.
Hello? Where are we here? I actually just turned it on.
And your name is?
Kat. Yeah, me and my friend are really good at the Cal, and I'm sort of wondering if you could do the Cal's voice, his response to getting hit on.
His response to what?
Getting hit on.
Getting hit on. Okay, you're over mine.
I think it's where the mic is.
Wherever the mic is. We have to go wherever the mic is. It's up to all of them.
Over here.
Okay, go ahead.
All right, you've been businessmen, madmen, government agents. Do you prefer doing good guy voices, bad guy voices? So you get the habit of bad guys, I guess, but do you have any preference?
I like ham.
Yeah, you just, an actor would just be aware of the scenery. You give this bad guy's woo.
That's heroes.
The only nice thing about a hero, the heroes are pretty boring. The only nice thing about a hero, for the most part, is that, as I said before, if we get the opportunity to play characters we generally don't play on screen. I mean, I get to have great abs and sensational biceps, triceps, and to get a little gross here, a huge puppy place. So it's always nice.
Now, there's more character in that guy because he's got a lot of bad enemy going for him. And you can find that and work with it. But the good guy has to sound almost one note.
Yeah.
And he shouts a lot.
Yeah, we all shout a lot. Do you remember those? You've seen enough of those to see.
It's always like this. It's always big and it's always strong.
Oh, me.
There's no one ever goes, oh, God, help me. The funny thing is that when you cry for help, you can't let your voice go up to that register because I know, we all know, you get to a certain point, somebody walks in the room, you don't know they're there, and no matter how butch you may be, you say, you really sound like a little kid next door. You can't do that. So when the bad guy's coming at you, and you're looking, and it says, ARRGHHHH, somebody help me. You can't go, hello, somebody help me. It's gonna be, somebody help me. Well, I can do it myself, but you know, maybe you can help me out a little bit. Where's the mic? Here we go. What's your name?
Srini.
Srini. How do you spell that?
Srini.
Okay.
It's for Greg Berger.
Yeah.
Duckman and Transformers are like favorite shows I've ever read. So I said you did an outstanding job of helping. Since Grimmon Corvette probably at least the most intelligent character ever played, which definitely no personality was. Could you do an impression of doing the meeting for the first time?
thing. What reminder are you from?
He worked with many, many, many beings and constructed gods and entities from many planets and galaxies.
I work for a private dick named Duckman.
You pick up check for Grimlock Lodge.
Yeah, I can promise like that.
Yes.
Cap is perhaps the oldest character portrayed in the Transformers series, and many of us fans have parody fan fiction that we enjoy. And I was wondering, could you please say, as Cap, plain men are fast, where's my medication? Plain men are fast, where's my medication?
I did.
Men are fast. Where's my medication?
Hi. Hey, my name is Sid. Can the three of you briefly address how your surroundings have changed over time? How working in the studio, different technology, different roles, how the industry has changed, work moving to Canada, things like that.
Oh, dirty word.
Well, I'll start off by saying that there's really no heart. The heart is being taken out of the animation industry, I think. The fun, it's mostly get the product out and get it on the screen, and some of them, there are a lot of holes in it, and it isn't really artistic approach to what we do or need. It's done piecemeal. You sometimes don't see the other people that in a particular episode you're working, and that's not talking about. We used to, and in some cases they still do, work the show from the top to the bottom, and there's interaction, interplay, fun when you're not on mic. When they're setting things up, it's an experience that you enjoy. You walk out of high. Now it's get there, get in, get out, and collect the check. I think
it's Taco Bell. It is now Taco Bell. At one point it was a boutique kind of business. We would sit down, we'd sit at a long table, and we'd all read the piece first, and the director would take you through it. And no matter how big the cast was, and you would work on those, you'd have those characters ready as you read your script. Don't forget, you had your character. This was some time ago, you owed them three voices. Now you owe them two voices for the price of one. We worked on that. But for a long period of time, we owed them three voices. So you had to do two subsidiary voices and a major voice, and then two major voices and a subsidiary voice, all with the same paycheck. That way they didn't have to pay two other actors to do those other two voices. So you really have to be versatile. And under the circumstances, when you sat down, you had that script, and you worked on all those different characters, you pulled them out of your bag, and you had them ready, and you were able to interact with the other actors, and you got to play, and you got to have a good time, and then they recorded. It was more family-oriented. Now it's cold, hard, slack. You go in, you do it. There's often not another actor with you, so you don't know what the other actor did that your reaction is to. So let's assume that they were being obsequious, or let's assume they were being sarcastic. You can react sarcastically, whereas you don't know. You have to depend upon the director you don't always trust. And then you wind up sometimes giving a performance, and then you see it on television or even in a film, you go, that's not the reaction to that. That's not what my character would have done. It's up there. That's what John is talking about. And that, you want to think that you're doing is artistic to some degree, and that it's all working as a unit. It doesn't always happen. When they can cut it together and it works that way, you don't know the difference.
So many of these questions like that one, we could talk for an hour on these subjects. I've had the great good fortune and luxury of working on The Simpsons. I understudy Sideshow Bob and Kelsey Grammer when he's not available to do table reads. They still maintain this process that we used to be familiar with, where it starts with a table read, it's refined and refined and refined, and even on record day, you record a scene, and they come running in with changes to the scene from what they just heard. Refine, and days before it goes to air, if there's something slightly topical or suggestive that they can add, you go back and you refill those mouth flaps with words of a better joke or whatever. There's a reason that they maintain the standard of excellence that I feel they do.
Well, I resent it. It's even studios like Disney putting out a one-line audition for a character, and you have no idea where he's coming from. You want to give them at least four shots at it, four different characters, but you can't always do this. They want one voice, and they're going to live and you're going to live and die with that, whatever you do.
I wanted to stay on the subject for a minute, and then I do have a response to the Canadian, some of the flight of the work to Canada. There are a lot of, at the moment, artists who are being drawn into the process because their work is good, and they may be young, just out of school, still in school. Cartoon Network is pulling in a lot of artists, and a lot of times they're given more autonomy than I think even they may be looking for in that stage of their career. So having created a character, that doesn't necessarily make them a voice director of note yet. So sometimes there's a process of fishing around or trying to make it happen too quickly or inability to communicate. That's a special skill, especially actor-directors who direct actors. There's a language, there's a shortcut to getting what you need without telling someone how to do it. Painting a picture for them so the director gets the result he wants, the actor is happy with the result, and the product works. Also, there's a good side and a bad side to these splits, mostly bad. Men in Black, we do all ensemble, it's all full company record. Darkman was done in splits. That worked to my advantage because I was on location in Russia for 2 months doing a film and was getting calls in the hotel. They sent me a little portable, like, spy tape recorder, which I had to explain at customs. But they were calling me in my room in Moscow. I was recording tracks from there, sending the digital audio tape via Federal Express, and being cut into the show from 8,000 miles away. So selfishly, it was a good thing. But as far as performance, there is no substitute for actors being allowed to sort of feed off each other and encouraged and allowed to be creative in session. As far as Canada, just very quickly, the concern.
As Canada.
The concern is that a lot of shows that begin the process down here and record auditions down here may decide sometime between that time and production time to take the production to Canada. If they do, this is not a paranoia because it's not unfounded. If they take voice tracks that they recorded here and shared sort of that creative beginning birthing process here,
and those tracks go to Canada, there is, I won't say a likelihood, but there's certainly a possibility that those voice tracks, which were all nurtured down here, begun down here, is going to pick up there where it left off here, where we were part of the birthing process, but not part of you know, the actual production. That is a concern.
Who's got the mic?
Hi. First of all, I'd like to say it's excellent to have you here. Nice to see the G1 voice actors from the Best of the Transformers series. And I personally really appreciate your discussion of the nature of the characters, you know, the entire nature of the character that goes into the voice of the conscious, showing up and reading with the mind. I personally appreciate that a lot. And that's kind of a frivolous question. I realize that all of you have done several different characters, but I guess you each had one really major famous character. We have essentially Thundercracker, Grimlock, and Prowl. And I noticed that the three of you are dressed in the colors of those characters, and I wonder if that was cool.
That's interesting. I don't think we gave any plans to that.
If so, it was on a deeply subliminal level.
We believe our characters. Who's got the mic next? Yes.
Am I on? Hi, my name is Camille. Quick question for you as actors. I know there are some shows that go on for a while and you have to do a number of characters. I was wondering if you ever have a problem with
character being over. I mean, a character is a voice and, more than that, a personality. You have to keep those personalities and individuals separate in your own mind. I was just wondering if you have the problem occasionally of characters sort of bleeding over into one another, and if so, how do you find the focus?
Well, I think for me, from series to series, there's only so far you can stretch yourself. You keep trying to stretch yourself as much as you can. But often, it's very interesting, I will find when I'm watching shows, and I will see a particular show, then see another show, and say, well, that's so interesting, that character, that actor, and sometimes myself, used on that show, is very, very similar to another show, because there's only so far I can go, unless I employ the use of the dialect, or humor, which will be helpful. So if it's
a character that talks like this in one show, perhaps he talks like this in another show. Maybe he has this sound like that in another show.
You know, so it's still the basic voice. If you listen to Mel Blanc, who to me is the quintessential great voice actor, there is not that much of a difference in terms of the tonality of his characters. It is the attitude of his characters, and maybe a slight wrinkle, the edge.
You know, like this. But still, if it's Buck or whoever it is, or it's Daphne, whatever.
It's something that else is employed, but the attitude is a little bit different. And you buy the fact that that's a different character. And that's really a kind of, there's a kind of magic to that. That if you're doing on camera, you need to do physically with makeup and latex, etc. Where we, as Greg pointed out, we paint the picture for you. If you couldn't see, you would know who that character was. If you couldn't see it. That's how we teach. There's an actress who does a Rugrats with me, Dion Kwan. She is blind, and she plays my daughter Kimmy on the series. And as a result, she has to listen to the other characters. And she had said to me, I knew who everybody was because you guys painted the picture for me. And she was the person who said, I'm going to get into this business because you guys asked about this earlier. And she persevered and studied acting and did the whole thing. And even she jokes about the fact, she said, I did stage work till I fell off. She said, well, I realized that was the wrong venue for my talent. So she said, I went back to the voiceover. She said, and she had studied with me for a short period of time. And then next thing I know, she's playing my daughter, and she's playing Kimmy on this thing. And she said, she listens to the characters, and then even her own character, she hears better than I, you know, when I close my eyes, I got to hear what that character sounds like. And you listen to it back, and you listen to other characters. It is not just the voice, because how far can I possibly go? You know, there's a few of us that have that range, a few of us have this range. You better make a living in this range. So you use dialects, but you employ your acting ability. And sometimes, yes, it does bleed over. But when I listen to Mel and I say, yeah, it bleeds over, but I buy it. It's great.
Now, engineers will try to help you with that. I mean, most of us in the field are capable of having conversations with ourselves. The engineer joke is, you listen back to a character who just talked to themselves and they say, I think you were overlapping yourself. But the way the engineers will help, even if you're capable of sustaining those changes through the course of the dialogue, which we've all done, is a lot of times they will do that in sections where you'll record one character all the way through and then you'll go back and pick up the other character all the way through. The biggest danger of bleeding over is when you're talking to yourself. Without a clear division, because you want to keep the flow of the scene going.
I didn't mind what I said at all, very succinctly, but in our first show, when we were in trouble with the Flintstones series, the first show of the Flintstones series, I found that not until I saw the show premiere in 1961, I believe, and saw myself coming in and out the door saying hello to myself. That's two different characters. And that show, because they were up against the wall and didn't realize it, I played nine characters. Now, where did that, Where did the three boys come from? It came from radio. They didn't know what to do with animation when they first came on the scene, but in radio, you were permitted and allowed, and in fact, it was necessary to use actors in three different characters. And we did it all the time. But when we got into animation, we say, what do we do? And they said, we want three voices from these characters. They said, well, that's impossible.
they, it was an impossible, and that's how they got the three voice rule in animation, where they were allowed to get that three, their voice for the same price as one.
You're gonna get married, you're gonna have kids. What fun to be able to tell your kids stories and be able to say, and the dragon came along and thank you, Daddy, you can't have that.
I wondered if you might shed a little more light on the things. You closed your eyes and you got yourself immediately. Your voice just changed. I went from hearing, I think, your natural voice a little more alpha triad. Now all of a sudden something clicked and you were cut.
To regurgitate these voice characters, but the one that was probably closest to me was Donna Kelpen, maybe alpha triad as an older person. Who was very soft-spoken and understanding and carried on and nothing rattled him. And then there were one-shot characters that I enjoyed very much. The Gambler was a one-shot as Bosch, I believe. He was an electric sort of character who talked like this and took everyone in. You love gambling. It was mostly Shakespearean, I would say. That sort of thing. So just to fill into Bruce, but when it comes to the other ones, you know, I did have to close my eyes and remember who he was and when he was. So when it comes to six characters and bringing them up like this, if this were 1983 instead of 2003, I would probably have a better opportunity to be on the nose.
I did a character called Outback, and I remember I would always stumble into the Australian dialect by three words. The three words were sit and vowel sand. They're set in vowel sounds that just throw you into Australian. Long haul with a big yellow dump truck, a lot of these, that's and those, and essentially no respect.
Skylight was a very interesting character, and I remember being particularly impressed with not only his size, strength, and stature, but his battle of conscience. If this is Bot Khan, he was the original Khan Bot.
And the other is easy.
Me Greenlock, me big and smart, but me have severe pronoun trouble.
Because, you know, I got some help last night when a group of really super ladies cornered me and said, do Proud Ears. They said, was it Autumn?
No, it was Autumn.
Okay. That's not bad. Autumn's not bad. He said, Winter, Spring, Fire. And they said, Proud, it was soft. And of course, it was right over there, early in the east wind. And then, of course, I remember Swoon, because I did a lot of Swoons, I recall. There was a TV show on Swoon.
Swoon! Ah, yes! Me, Swoon!
Which is, I think I'm illegitimate Grimlock somewhere down there. Now, I must be honest with you, I can't remember First Day Bombshell and Scrapper and Sideswipe in my head, because you had to come up with it. Then, as they say, they'd go, hey, do this, or you can do this character, and say, we talked about imprint. Well, let's see. I did this.
Maybe I think deeper here and not
his vibes, because I would need an injection for that. But I'd still,
you know, get it down here.
And maybe someone's up here. You know, someone's in this area here.
So I was all over the place until I could lock in. So I really can't tell you exactly where Sideswipe, Scrapper, Prancer, Dancer, and Dixon sound like. Actually, maybe you'd have to remind me. If you remind me, you can come up with it. You found what?
Well, Dr. Fujiyama, obviously because it's Japanese, background would have, you know, that sound.
There's this special comic, Bot Khan, illustrated by a guy with a lot of trans food, and
I'm still more on Prowl's, basically called the head, and Grimlock's really smart, so I was wondering, you know, could Prowl, like, say, shut up crime and have Grimlock be sounding smart and educate and then black?
Now, why do you put out saying, shut up, Prime, in a particular attitude, you mean?
Yeah.
Like a bad attitude?
Yeah.
Okay. So, shut up, Prime, with a bad attitude. Okay, stop it, Prime. Madman. Shut up.
The Grimlock is smart, you cesium salami! You want cesium baloney? What you talk about?
Sounds like the Crimson of the Bloods.
You know, that isn't funny to talk about everybody else having a bloodbath. Plenty of having a vocal bloodbath years ago on our very show, and dinosaurs were involved. I was asked to do a sound effect of one of the two dinosaurs in a battle, a life and death battle, and I ended up growling.
Sounds? And as I was doing this, I looked at my script and there was blood on it. And I said, I lost my career!
Instead, after the show, I kept going because the show has to go on. I went directly to the ENT man, and he gave me an exam and said, no, you have ruptured a little thing, but it's going to be all right.
You were very fortunate you never did adult films, John.
Yeah.
I got to tell you, just to go very quickly, in terms of, again, Mel Blanc, a commitment. I don't know if anybody grew up with Speed Buggy, it was years ago. And Mel, of course, was really tall. Mel would just, you know, and I had an opportunity to work with Mel, and he sat on my right, and I was the lead young, young guy character, spoke every young guy song, like, oh, golly, Miss Brooks, you know, like Richard Crenna, we all did this wonderful sound, and here's, I'm working with the great Mel Blanc. We did a couple of commercials together, but not on a steady basis, and Mel is on my right, and all the guest casts are over here, the guest bad guy, there's always a guest bad guy that's going to try to beat this car, and, you know, Mel was just a little and he was sitting on my right, and we're getting underway in the script, commitment, and I have a line here, and he goes, yeah, and I'm sopping wet. And Mel, there's nobody else in the room. Twice Mel goes, he was never there. And I'm sitting there, good. God, and I've got a whole show to go. And here we go along with the show, and he goes, okay, and I found myself throughout the show going like this. Something left, like, pushing me out of the way. So the next show,
no, I can tell this story.
And at the end of that show, I was a towel, and it was like doing stuff like that. I never wore short sleeves again, and I was like, a flannel and a towel over there, and I would never say anything to him, because that's what he does. The next time, the next show we had come in, we had a bad guy come in, his guest star was my friend Alan Oppenheimer, who's great fun to play jokes on. And I said, Al, since your stuff is basically the known, why don't you sit next to him? So Al sits next to him, and nobody else notices. I've never said anything to anybody else in the cast. We're all a seat down. Sitting is like radio. We're all sitting on these mics. They're in Hanna-Barbera, these long chairs, etc. And it's like, I'm looking at Al and just wanted to see his first reaction. And of course, Mel does it. And then Al was like, this out of looking at the script, just waiting for the next time, you'll like this. Every time that happens, Al, I can see slowly leaning towards me. I'm pushing, I have to tell you that, because that's just the all-time great on Mel Blanc.
You asked for Agent K. Shoot him, Jay. Shoot him. He's a cerebral cephalopod. Their brains are in their bottoms.
Sorry, Jay. Jay, you can't drive, Jay. You
achieve, Jay.
Unfortunately, with that, unless our guests have any closing thoughts or words of wisdom for us.
I have some words of wisdom. That question about talking about each other, it's easier to talk about the entire voice community than it is to talk about specific guys in it. I'm an eternal optimist, and I pretty much like everybody until they give me a reason not to. I consider the entire voice community that we work in to be so considerate of each other. I think there's an understanding in every waiting room that anybody on that couch can do anything that is needed, and that you get what you get because you were right for a specific application. Not that you were better than anybody else, more talented, more versatile, more anything, just more right that day for that project. I think there is so much respect that I see, in addition to the fact that those lobbies have the best jokes anywhere in Hollywood. For those of us who work in the on-camera community as well, I think there's a much more competitive atmosphere in the waiting rooms of on-camera auditions. It's primarily, more often than not, it's going to start and end with a look. You've got to look right. That's something you have to bring in. It's not something that you can add when you get in. You sort of got what you got. The rest is going to be told by the way you interpret the material. But like I said, I think at the beginning of this, we can be any size, any shape, any ethnicity, any anything, all of us. And the only limitations are your own. And I consider myself very fortunate to be in this community, not only because of the level of talent involved, but also the fact that it tends to be we're readers. What we do is read, and it tends to be a very well-read community. If you don't get it from the past hour, you won't get it. Funny community, smart, intelligent, funny, talented, and considerate. I'm joking.
And you guys, thank you so much, guys. Yeah. To have fans like you, to have that kind of interest, is really overwhelming for us, right? Because we kind of put this to bed and thought, oh, well, that's it, we did that one, to the next thing, and had no idea you were out there. Thank you, and thank you for my school.
Radio Free Cybertron, the first, the best.
And that is Radio Free Cybertron. I'm Brian Kilby, going to bed right now. Tune back next week for more stuff.